Well, thank you, Mr. Hansen, and good afternoon, everyone. It's good to see all of you here today. Just looking to see if we have any visitors with us. I don't spot any offhand, but if there are any, welcome to you, and welcome to those listening over the webcast today. Well, our lives are made up of decisions and choices. And there's a saying that our lives are a sum total of the choices we have made. And there are several versions of that quote, but as nearly as I can tell, it's attributed to the motivational speaker, Dr. Wayne Dyer, who said that. Well, how many decisions have you made today already? You decided when to get up, what to eat, what to wear, when to leave, how to get here. Those are just the minor things, just getting through the day. We've got major decisions that we have to make too, and some of those that are in between. And some decisions are just choices that have several possibilities that we can choose any one of them and be fine. But how do we learn to make decisions? And how does God teach us to make decisions? How does God work with us to make these decisions and choices? Well, it's kind of like a parent and child. As infants, we're totally dependent upon our parents or other caregivers to look after us. And initially, our parents have to look at what needs to be done. They have to decide it, and they have to do those things. The child is totally dependent. As they grow older and they're able to understand directions, the parents can teach them how to do things that are within their capability. The parents decide what they must continue to do for their children and what their children are able to learn when the time is right and how to teach and train them. And as children, we don't know what we don't know, so we don't know to ask questions because we don't know what we're missing. Every new thing must be introduced to us because we wouldn't even have known to ask for it. Well, God works in the same manner in training and preparing us for his kingdom. He has a master plan that helps each of us to learn and to grow and to learn how to make the right decisions along the way. There's a parallel between how parents teach their children and how God teaches us. But I found it interesting that we can see a third parallel too when we look at how God worked with ancient Israel and how he taught them. And that's what I want to look at in this message this afternoon. Throughout the Bible, Israel faced a number of problems and choices, and sometimes they chose to work with God, sometimes without God, and other times even against God. They made a lot of bad decisions along the way. But when we look at a pattern of the ways that God worked with them and taught them, we can see how he might work with us today. So I could see three phases of decision-making in the Bible, and I'd like to look at those and see how they apply to our lives today, too. And I call them phases because there seems to be a progression from one to the next, and certainly they're overlapping, but there are different types of decision-making. So the first part, phase one, is when we're told what to do without asking. We don't have any input in it. As I mentioned, an infant is completely dependent upon its parents, and the parents completely decide what needs to be done, and they either have to do it for the child, or once the child gets older, they have to tell the child exactly what to do. And this is the way that God worked in the Bible, too. Let's look at a few examples of this type of decision-making. First of all, go back to the beginning with Adam and Eve, and this is from Genesis 2, Genesis 2, verses 15 through 20. In verse 15, then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. And the Lord commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. So if Adam were just left there on his own, and he saw all these trees, he saw this fruit, first of all, he may not even know that it's edible, and it's something that he could or should eat. And he certainly wouldn't have been able to tell one tree from another and to know what is good and what isn't without trying it. God had to tell him this because this was something he couldn't find on his own without actually going out there and sampling it, and even knowing that he should try to sample it. In the next verse then, and the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him. Did Adam know that he was alone? He maybe knew that something was different about him and all the other animals. If he could see several rabbits or several what other animals he might have seen in the area there, he could see that they came in more than one. And over time, he would see how they reproduce and how they're baby ones. And he might have thought that he was missing something, but he wouldn't have known what. God is the one who decided that. He decided that he needed a mate. And so God went on and created a mate for Adam. A second example is that of Noah. And this is in Genesis chapter 6. Certain verses between between 5 and 22. In verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Now Noah could look around and he could see that there was evil in the world around him, but he probably didn't know what to do about it. In verse 13, God told him, God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. So if that's all the further God had gone, Noah would know that everyone else was going to be destroyed. But we know that it says Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, so he probably felt that he would be spared. And what would he do on his own? Just sit and wait for it to happen and not know when it was going to happen or how soon or if there's something that he should be doing. I don't think that out of the blue Noah would say to himself, I'm going to build an ark. That's an idea that just wouldn't come to a person. But in verse 14, God tells him, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And then he goes on to say, and this is how you shall make it. God spoke to him. He told him about the length and the height and the depth. Width of it. He said you should put a window in it and a door, make it with lower and second and third decks. And then he goes on to tell him why. He says, I'm going to bring floodwaters on the earth. But he says he'll establish his covenant with Adam. And then he goes on to tell him to take for yourself of all food that is eaten. You shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and for them. Thus Noah did, according to all that God commanded him, so he did. So God had to tell him exactly what to do and how to do it, and he explained why he was going to do it. He told Noah he would have to bring in enough food to eat. Noah wouldn't have known how much food he needed otherwise. And then, of course, saving all the animals. Noah wouldn't have known any of this. He wouldn't have known that he needed to do any of it, or to even ask about it, because the thoughts wouldn't have come to him. And that's the same way we are as infants. We have to be told. A third example was Abram, or Abraham. And this is in Genesis 12, verses 1 through 9. Now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. And he went on to tell him about how he was going to make a great nation out of him, how he was going to be a blessing, and that I will bless those who bless you and curse him who curses you. And it says in verse 4, so Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. I used to read this and think, wow, that's pretty old. Now I look at it and say, oh, that's not so old. But our thoughts change about that, I guess. And by this time, the lifespan was 120 years, or that's what it was said at, although Abram lived to be, I believe, 175 years old. So in that perspective, he wasn't even at the halfway point in his life. But he took his wife, and he took Lot, and he took their possessions, and it said he took all the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. And they passed on through the place of Shechem and Moreh. And there he built an altar to the Lord, went on to Bethel, pitched a tent there and another old altar. And in verse 9, it says, so Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. And again, this is a case where God had to tell him directly what to do. Because I would guess that he had been in the land with his father and his parents, his whole family, he had settled there, and he would need a strong reason to come up with that idea on his own to move. But God told him where to go, and that's how this decision was made. Later on, of course, he faced a bigger test, and this is certainly something that he would not have come up with on his own. And that's with his son Isaac. Abraham and Isaac in Genesis 22. It came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham. And I don't think any one of us dreams up a test that we are going to ask for. And this is certainly not an idea that Abraham would have come up with, to take his son, his only son Isaac, whom you love, as it said, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering. Just the idea of a burnt offering, of sacrificing a human, was not something that Abraham would do. But God told him to, and he trusted God, and we know the rest of the story, what happened there. Two more brief examples. Jacob in Genesis 35. God said to Jacob, arise and go to Bethel and dwell there and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother. So Jacob had had relationships with God before this. God had appeared to him and he trusted God. So he told his household and he gathered them together and said, let us rise and go up to Bethel and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I have gone. There was a trust built up there, and he trusted God, just as children trust their parents to be right in what they're asking them to do. And it goes on to say that they journeyed on, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were all around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. So they were protected in their travels, because they followed God and were obedient to what he told them to do. And the last example of this type of teaching is Moses. Exodus 2:23 through Exodus 3, verse 4. It happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. And we know the story of Moses and how God spoke to him in the burning bush. That's in Exodus 3, verse 2. And Moses said, now I'll turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. And God told him not to look. Do not draw near this place. And he gives him some instructions. He says, in verse 8 of Exodus 3, God talks to Moses. So I have come down to deliver them, talking about the Egyptians, because he says he's heard their cry and he sees their oppression. He says, I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up from the hand, from that land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. And up to this point, I'm sure Moses was very eager to hear all this. All right, they're going to be free. Their oppression is going to be over. God's going to end their suffering. He's going to make things right. And then we come to verse 10. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. And at that point, you can just see the panic entering in Moses. It's okay if God's going to do this, and all I have to do is sit back and wait for it to happen. But you want me to do that? This is not something that Moses would have done on his own. He wouldn't have known that he could do it even. But God told him that he could and that he would. So notice that in every one of these examples, God initiated the contact and the actions. He told them what to do and how to do it, just as a parent and child. A parent has to tell the child what to do, has to tell them how to do it. And I looked up to see how many people God actually spoke to directly. And I just did a Google search. I found one site where some person compiled a list, and he came up with 22 different people that God spoke to directly. I didn't realize there were that many, but I didn't check all the references with them, but I accept that there were that many. And he said at the end, I don't think my list is complete. So God worked this way with a number of people. Well, as children, we need to be taught. We learn by watching and imitating our parents. Children need to be told and guided in whatever chores or tasks are expected. They need to be told that they have to pick up their toys and what to do with them, how to tie their shoes. They need to be taught how things work. They need to be shown nature and see some of the samples of plants and animals and how many different kinds they are. And the parents have to set the limits on the food their children eat and the amount of time for play and games and videos or other things, and when to nap, when to go to bed. The children are totally guided by their parents. And initially, both us and ancient Israel were guided by God. Our spiritual lives begin in the same way. In some cases, God practically forces us to make a decision when we didn't even know one was necessary. And I went through something like this when I was in college, and I had flipped on the radio one night, and I heard this radio program, Ambassador College Presents the World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong. And I started listening to that, and eventually started sending for some literature and Plain Truth magazine, started reading it. But in the meantime, I was still going to, I was going to Hamlin. I went to the Methodist church that was right across the street from Hamlin. And I liked that church. It was a very ornate old building. I liked the interior of it. I liked the organ and the music. I don't remember any of the messages I heard. I think sometimes I judged the quality by the length. And that was inversely proportional. But at any rate, at some point, I started to think that, well, maybe I shouldn't be here, because I had been reading that there's a Sabbath day, it's on Saturday, and I was here on Sunday, and I just didn't know what to do, so I kind of mentally said to God, well, if this isn't the place to be, then let one of those candles go out. And I started watching the candles, and everything was fine. They all stayed lit, so kind of forgot about that. But then toward the end, I looked up again, and one of those candles was not burning. Now, I don't know if that was a sign from God. It may have been, it may not have been. But At least I took it as something that I needed to look into further. And I actually don't remember how long I kept going there until I stopped. But you also have to remember that when I listened to the radio program, it was a college that was sponsoring it. They didn't talk about a church behind it. And it wasn't until you looked into some of the literature more and started requesting a visit or something that you realized that there was a church behind this. So in my mind, I didn't have an alternative. I knew that that might not be the right place, but I didn't know where the right place was. Well, God works with us. Like I say, sometimes he just has to kind of drill something into us when we don't even know that we're looking for it. Well, next we come to phase two. That's when we ask God and we receive a definite answer. Ancient Israel went through this. Now, children go through it too. They come to a point when they start to ask their parents. They ask them how to do something. They ask for permission to do something. They need help in making decisions. They're at the point where they know that there is a question to ask and a decision to be made, but they don't yet know what to do about it. So the parents usually have either a direct answer or they can guide the child into making the right choice. Now, I am fortunate. I have hypothetical children, and my hypothetical children always listen, and they do what the parent says. So if there's a problem there, I haven't experienced it other than from the child's side, I guess. Well, spiritually, the next phase of growth involves asking God and relying on God for our decisions. He's willing and desirous to help us, but we need to do our part by asking him. And there's an interesting example of this in the Old Testament pertaining to ancient Israel, and that's the Urim and the Thummim. We don't know exactly what they were. They're associated with a priest's breastplate or ephod. And they provided a way for God to communicate with his people. And the Bible says that the breastplate contained 12 jewels, one for each tribe of Israel. We can see this in Exodus 31, verses 26 through 30. Exodus 31, starting in verse 26. You shall make two rings of gold and put them on the two ends of the breastplate, on the edge of it, which is on the inner side of the ephod. And it goes on to describe how to put these in there. And in verse 30, and you shall put in the breastplate the judgment of judgment, the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be over Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord. So Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually. But still, it doesn't say how they work. We can get some indication of this. International Standard Bible Encyclopedia indicated that these may have been two additional jewels that were there besides the 12 that were in the breastplate. And it said that they may have reflected light in a certain manner to indicate a yes or a no. Of course, this is speculation, but we can see them in use in 1 Samuel 23, 1 Samuel 23, verse 9. When David knew that Saul plotted evil against him, he said to Abiathar the priest, bring the ephod here, bring this breastplate that has these jewels on it, and the Urim and the Thummim on it. Then David said, O Lord God of Israel, your servant has certainly heard that Saul seeks to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake. Verse 11, will the men of Keilah deliver me into his hand? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? O Lord God of Israel, I pray tell your servant. And the Lord said, he will come down. And David said, will the men of Keilah deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul? And the Lord said, they will deliver you. So David and his men, about 600, arose and departed from Keilah and went from wherever they could go. Now notice the questions he were asking, they were yes or no questions. So somehow these Urim and Thummim could give them a yes or a no. And he was phrasing them very carefully where a yes or no would give him the answer that he needed. They were used for major decisions, and there was probably some kind of a ritual that was involved in asking, but the answer that came back from God was very specific. And the people had absolute confidence that the answer was from God. And so they were willing to trust it and obey it. Now, some examples in the Bible show that there's also some way for God to elaborate and provide more details. And we can see an example of this in Judges 20. Judges 20 in verses 18 through 28. This is when Israel was at war with the Benjamites. In Judges 20, verse 18, then the children of Israel arose and went up to the house of God to inquire of God. They said, which of us shall go up first to battle against the children of Benjamin? The Lord said, Judah first. Now, we don't know if they asked a series of yes or no questions to narrow it down or how that worked, but somehow God was able to tell them Judah should go first. And it goes on in verse 20, the men of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin, and in that battle they lost. They lost 22,000 men. So it says, then the children of Israel, in verse 23, the children of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until evening. Again they went to God and asked counsel of the Lord, saying, shall I again draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin? And the Lord God, and the Lord said, go up against him. So this is after they had lost 22,000 men. Surely a lot of them were thinking, well, it's not something we should be doing. Look how many men we lost. But God told them to go up again against them. And this time in verse 25, it says they lost 18,000 more. So this is twice they've gone up to God. Twice God has told them to go up in battle against the Benjamites, and twice they've lost, a total of 40,000 already. In verse 26, then all the children of Israel, that is all the people, went up and came to the house of God and wept. It says they fasted and they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And once again, they still trusted God, still trusted him to give them an answer, and they were still willing to follow him. The children of Israel inquired of the Lord. The Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days, and Phinehas the son of Eleazar the son of Aaron stood before it in those days, saying, shall I yet again go out to battle against the children of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease? And you can just imagine them almost hoping for a no answer. You've lost enough men. But the Lord said, go up. And then he says, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand. So they asked God. He gave them a definite answer, and they believed him, they trusted him, and they followed it. Now, sometimes God didn't answer. You don't need to turn there, but in 1 Samuel 28:6, it says, when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by the prophets. So those were the three ways that God could speak to them. He could use the Urim and the Thummim, or he could come to them in dreams, or by prophets. Now, in all of these answers that God gave, they were very reassuring, very specific, and the people only had to ask. Now, in our physical lives, we come to an age where we ask our parents, for whatever it might be, we ask if we can stay up late, we can visit friends overnight, if we can get a pet, or we ask how to save or spend money, and generally the parent decides up to a certain point. And spiritually we ask God for help, and he leads us to an answer. That brings us to the third phase. The first phase was just kind of passively sitting there and God reaching out to us and telling us to do something. The second phase is our asking God, and he gives us a specific answer. And the third phase is one more of consultation and responsibility on our parts. The Urim and the Thummim aren't recorded in the Bible after the times of David. After that, people generally went to the prophets for answers. And again, according to the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, and I'll just quote this verbatim here, it says, the basic reason for their demise, the Urim and Thummim, seems to have been that God was weaning his people away from a physical means of revelation to a greater dependence on his word as written or as spoken by the prophets. Thus the prophets grew in importance at the expense of the high priest in answering inquiries with divine revelation. Still quoting, this meant that the easy certainty offered by a mechanical aid for revelation, such as the Urim and Thummim, in whatever manner they have functioned, gave way to the more difficult application of the norms of true and false prophecy. This development demanded greater spiritual discernment. And that's what God expects from us. As we grow spiritually, God expects us to make more of the decisions. He'll help us along. He'll give us examples. We have plenty of examples recorded. We have plenty of helps to look at. But God doesn't always give us a direct answer. We have to discern it for ourselves. Now, in the Bible, we can see an example of this in 2 Samuel 16. This is at the point where Absalom had gone against his father. He was warring against his father David. And he was seeking advice whether this was the time to go and attack David or not. And first of all, he sought advice from Ahithophel. This is in 2 Samuel 16:20. Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, give a counsel as to what we should do. And Ahithophel gives him some advice, tells him to go into his father's concubines. And it says Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. This is to humiliate David. And it says, now the advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one had inquired at the oracle of God. So was all the advice of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom. And basically, Ahithophel was telling Absalom that this was the right time for him to go in and attack David. But he sought a second opinion. And in verse 5 of 2 Samuel 17, it says, then Absalom said, now call Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear what he says too. And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom spoke to him, saying, Ahithophel has spoken in this manner. Shall we do as he says? If not, speak up. So Hushai said to Absalom, the advice that Ahithophel has given you is not good at this time. He's not saying it was bad. He was just saying the timing was off. And he more or less said that they should wait a little bit till they gather their forces. They said that David is going to be on guard right now. This isn't the right time to go attack him. They had to make a decision. Which prophet were they going to follow? Which advice were they going to follow? Now, Absalom didn't know that David had prayed to Hushai to give Absalom bad advice. And it was advice that sounded very good. And it would have been good in certain circumstances, but it was advice that turned out to be good for David rather than Absalom. Well, as we grow and mature physically, we need to take more responsibility for our own decisions. The teenager may ask a parent about a decision, and the parent offers advice, but often leaves the final decision up to the son or daughter. The teen may say, I think I'd like to buy whatever it is with this money I've saved. And the parent might say, well, it's your money. You can make your own decision. Another thing you could do is, I know you've been talking about wanting this other thing that costs a little bit more. You could wait and save until you have enough for that. A decision like that is completely up to the person to make on his own. And that's the way God will work with us. He can say, well, you can do this or this, and kind of show us the outcomes of either one. And what happens if parents don't teach their children to decide for themselves? What if they continue to lord it over their children all of their lives so that the child is completely dependent on someone else? I actually met someone like this once. This was maybe 30 years ago. And I had some friends. It was someone I had met on the bus. He lived nearby. He was in his 20s at the time. We used to get together on Saturday nights sometime, just play cards or whatever. He and his brother and this other friend I hadn't met before came over to my house one night. And this other guy, his name was John. I have never run across anyone like that. I was asking people what they wanted to drink. You want, you know, Coke or root beer, whatever the choices were. And John, what would you like? I don't know. Well, do you want something to drink? I don't know. Do you want some root beer? I don't know. Well, I'll bring you some root beer then. And, you know, you just had to decide for him. And later on, we were thinking, hey, it might be good to get some chips and dip. Let's just go to the store. And the other two guys and I were, we thought it might sound good, but we thought we'd leave it up to John to decide. And, well, you know how that went. Well, I don't know. And finally, this friend of mine just said to him, okay, look, John, I want you to say something. Say yes or say no. Doesn't matter which one you say. We're okay with either answer. And I don't remember what he said, but somehow he did get an answer out of him. I think that must have been a major milestone for him. I don't know. But anyway, that's what can happen if you're not raised and not taught to make decisions. And so God leaves it more and more up to us to decide for ourselves. And spiritually, God begins to leave the decisions up to us. He's there to help. He'll hear our prayers when we ask. He'll point us toward a decision, but we have to decide and take responsibility for that decision. So what is this all saying? Well, just as Israel grew and matured in their relationship with God, and just as we grow and mature physically, we also need to grow and mature spiritually. And ultimately, it's not how God answers that matters, but it matters that he does answer. He does provide an answer. He uses whatever method is right for the circumstances and for the individual and for the times. God's there to help, but we need to do our part. No matter how the answer comes, whether we're being led in a certain direction we weren't aware of, or whether we ask of God and he provides an unmistakable response, whether the time is even right for an answer at all, we need to have faith that the answer does come from God. We have the responsibility of bringing our requests to God, and no matter how God chooses to respond, we then have the responsibility of deciding whether to obey.